Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, and back in the KZUX studios, and welcoming you to the February 18th, 2015 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Rebecca Gordon, author of Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in Post-9/11 United States, is a lecturer in the philosophy department at the University of San Francisco and a member of the wartime Tiempo de Guerra Collective, which I guess started around the Iraq War. She was already a seasoned political activist when I first met her in the late 80s, working in opposition to U.S. intervention in Central America, particularly in Nicaragua, while focusing on feminism and racism here at home. On a personal note, I owe a great deal to Rebecca and to her partner, Jan Adams, for having taken the time, beginning back in 1988 and long after that, to instruct and guide me in the ways of Macintosh and how to put together a magazine, which I edited for 7 years. I'm very pleased to welcome Rebecca Gordon to Takes on the World. Hello, Rebecca. It's great to have you with us. We'll start off with a question that everyone might agree with or torture is not a subject that most people like to think about, talk about, or hear about. But as you point out in your book, Mainstreaming Torture, as the title implies, it gained an unprecedented prominence and in America a disturbing degree of acceptance in the wake of 9/11. How difficult was it for you to write such a book and then get a publisher?
Those are two very different questions, right? How difficult was it to write the book? I actually began thinking about U.S. torture in the context of September 11th as early as December 2001, because it was already becoming clear, you just had to read the newspaper, that whatever other responses the United States might be going to have to those attacks of September 11th, one of them was going to include torture. So you may remember that as early as November 2001, we saw in Newsweek an article by a person named Jonathan Alter, who's a historian and journalist, identifying himself as a liberal, saying, in this autumn of our anger, even a liberal like me finds his thoughts turning to torture, as if the obvious response to a terrible crime was that somebody needed to be tortured. And so I began writing at that point. I was in graduate school, but I also began thinking about it. And part of the reason I knew this would be part of our response was that earlier in my life, I'd spent time in Central America, in Nicaragua and El Salvador, and had gotten to know people who had been tortured by regimes that my own government supported and trained. So I knew that it was part of the arsenal of U.S. potential response. But then I sort of buried myself in this stuff for another 10 years, and finding the publisher was a complete one of those pieces of serendipity. A friend of mine knew an editor at Oxford and asked me to send the manuscript. I sent the manuscript. It took them about a year and a half to accept it, but eventually it came out. I had three reviewers. You know, when you publish with an academic publisher, they send it out to your peers to see whether this is adequate scholarship and so forth. So the first reviewer loved it. The second reviewer hated it and said, maybe I could get an article for a journal out of it, but I should probably just give it up. And then the third person really liked it. So it took a long time.
Well, it certainly, as you point out, it's not easy to write a book about torture. It's not a popular subject, or at least it wasn't before 9/11. And as you point out, not only Jonathan Alter, but Alan Dershowitz, but even in our entertainment media program like 24, the hero is not the one being tortured. Jack Black is the torturer.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's the truth about that very first season of 24 is that they had already prepared it and had it ready to go before September 11th. And it was just a complete stroke of luck for Fox and for, you know, Fox TV and the producers that this had happened, because, of course, it made it so much more attractive. But what that program did was it crystallized in the minds of people in this country exactly the wrong understanding of what torture really is. Torture is not a lone hero who, on his own, almost as a lone wolf, single-handedly saves a city from annihilation by torturing the one person who can prevent it from happening. Real torture, the way it really works, is an institution. It's a state institution that's embedded in the society. It has an infrastructure. It has ways that people are brought into it, rituals of initiation. It has its own traditions, its own set of internal values. And it's a lot harder to root out than a lone operative like Jack Bauer going around saving us all from evil terrorists.
Well, you point out that it's impossible for a practice of torture to continue and survive without the support of some elements of the government that is benefiting or supposedly benefiting from it.
That's exactly right, because that gets to sort of the purpose of what I call institutionalized state torture. We are led to believe in all torture, even in well-known torture regimes like Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, Brazil, Greece, the Philippines, all the places where there have been strong institutionalized torture regimes, even in that context, the pretext for the torture is the interrogation, the desire to get information. But the reality is that over and over again, people who have been tortured, who finally give up a name or an address or a meeting place, something like that, what they hear over and over again is, "We already knew that. We just wanted to hear you say it." Because it's not really about information at all. What the purpose of institutionalized state torture is to establish and maintain the power of the regime. That's what it's for, and that's what it does.
You have a quote, a scary quote from a woman named Elaine Scarry, in which she says the torture is the intentional unmaking of a human being's world.
That's exactly
through
right.
Through pain.
That's right. Elaine Scarry is a magnificent philosopher, and she wrote a book called The Body in Pain, which is an astonishing book. But in it, she talks about exactly that torture is the unmaking of a person's world. And it happens on the psychological level, on the sensory level, and on the social level. So on the sensory level, if you've ever had severe physical pain, you know that that's the only thing in that moment that you can pay attention to. If it's that bad, you can't distract yourself. And as William Kavanaugh, another person who's written about this, he's a theologian, says, if the body shrinks down, the whole world shrinks down just to the contours, the outlines of your own body. And in the same moment, you lose your ability to speak, you lose your language. And as human beings, we are linguistic beings. The way that we interact with the world is through language. And not only that, even if we're not speaking with other individuals or reading something, we are constantly in our own minds using language to interpret the world around us, where there's this inner monologue that goes on all the time. And when, again, you are in that kind of pain, you lose the capacity for language. And so that's the first step. The next thing is that on a temporal level, you lose any sense of time because you never know whether you're ever going to be released from this particular form of hell. And so people over and over again have said, you know, it's as if the past had no relevance to me and there was no future. There's just this eternal now. And then your social world, which before you were picked up, included friends, family, members of organizations that you might have been part of, which is very likely why you were picked up. And all of those relationships are now cut off. And the only relationship you have is with the representatives of the state, essentially with your torturers. And so what torture does is it takes an individual who has a whole social nexus and cuts all of those strings and reduces that person to an atomized individual whose only relationship now is with the people who are torturing him or her. And at the same time, this is the really insidious part, torture only works if people actually know that it's happening, if people on the outside know that it's happening. So some of those people will be tortured, will betray the people that they care about most, will have to live with the shame of that betrayal, and then will be released back out on the street. And then the organizations that they were part of look at them and wonder, you know, what did she say? Whom did she betray? Who did she give up? And that distrust creeps into the whole organization and pulls it apart from the inside out. And it's a profoundly effective way of attacking organizations through the bodies and minds of individuals.
Well, we keep hearing that the hypothetical ticking bomb justification, but I have, other than in the movies, I don't remember ever reading about a situation in which someone has been tortured and given information which then immediately has saved any number of lives. It just seems something for movie fiction or an argument in favor of it.
That's exactly right. It never happens. This is the quintessential, this is the scenario that is used to excuse and explain all the torture that actually does happen. Even Jonathan Alter, when he was saying, you know, we need to torture people, the people he was talking about were around 600 Muslims living in the United States, many of them legal permanent residents, some of them here on visas, some of them U.S. citizens. And he wasn't even saying we need to torture these people to prevent another attack. He was saying we need to torture them because the FBI isn't getting any information from them about who was responsible for September 11th. Well, there was a reason for that. They didn't have any information. But even Jonathan Alter wasn't saying this is necessary to keep us safe. However, that is the excuse that we hear over and over again now from Dick Cheney and the other people who are still defending what happened under the Bush administration and what, in a different context, in a different means, is still unfortunately happening in the Obama administration, especially with the drone program. All of it is for the pretext of keeping us safe. And a lot of people have called this way of communicating with us in the United States through torture as security theater. And it sort of goes like this. This is the logic of why we were allowed, to know that torture was happening. I'm not saying that, for example, the Bush administration was thrilled when Seymour Hersh published photographs of Abu Ghraib and the terrible tortures that happened there, which were really amateur hour compared to things that the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command were doing. But when those pictures came out, they were able to take advantage of it in a way by making this argument to the people in this country. The argument goes like this. Our government is a good government. We are a government that defends human rights around the world. If our government, this good government, is forced to do such terrible things, think how terrible the people must be that we are doing it to. And think how terrible the danger must be that you, American, are in, and only we can protect you. And you're constantly reminded of this danger. For example, every time you go to the airport, you take off your shoes, you take off your belt, you put your liquids into a quart-sized baggie, no bigger, no smaller. All of this is ritual and theater that is designed to remind you how much danger you're in and that the government is the entity that can protect you.
And the other thing, of course, is, as you point out, is that people who are being questioned and have no information or being asked for information or to acknowledge the crimes they've committed, they will admit to anything in order
to stop the
terror.
And not only that, very often they'll actually even believe the things that they're admitting to that aren't true. So there was an example that appeared in the New York Times very early on in 2003, after the U.S. had gone into Iraq and before what was going on at Abu Ghraib was actually revealed. The New York Times did a piece. They had interviewed someone who had been held at Abu Ghraib and eventually released. The poor guy's first name was Saddam. His last name was Aboud, A-B-O-U-D. And he was in his 60s, so an older man who had been picked up, as many people were in Iraq, for no particular reason or because a neighbor had ratted on them. And he was tortured for 18 days before they even interrogated him. And then at a certain point, after they had been torturing him, they began asking questions. And the first question was, do you know Zawahiri, who was a Jordanian who was thought to be one of the leaders of the armed resistance to the U.S. in Baghdad and in Iraq in general? And so this man, Mr. Aboud, said, oh, yes, I know him. In fact, I'm his driver. Well, he wasn't his driver. But at that moment, he actually believed it was true. So they said, oh, well, that's very interesting. Do you know Osama bin Laden? And then he had this even more startling revelation. He said, not only do I know bin Laden, I am bin Laden, but I'm in disguise. And what he told the New York Times was he believed it, and he would have said anything to make them stop the torture. So this is the kind of information that you get from torture. And the truth is that if you are willing to torture thousands of people, you can, in fact, destroy organized resistance. So, you know, there are two classic historical cases from the 20th century. The first is in Algeria, when in the 1950s, when the French decided that they were going to torture pretty much every Arab man between the ages of about 15 and 45 in the city of Algiers in order to destroy the National Liberation Front, which was organizing in little cells in Algiers. And in fact, they succeeded for about 3 years and in dismantling the apparatus of organized resistance to the French. But 4 or 5 years later, it didn't matter because the organization came back. The other classic example from the U.S., where we took over from the French, is in Vietnam. Under what was called the Phoenix Program, something approaching 30,000 Viet Cong were, what they used to call it, was pump and dump. So they were pumped for whether or not they got any, and then dumped into the South China Sea from helicopters, oftentimes while they were still alive. And this was, again, a program that looked like it was interrogation, but the real purpose was to terrorize both the people who were actively involved in resisting the U.S. and also any ordinary civilians who might be tempted to collaborate with the Viet Cong.
Now,
as we know, it didn't work in the long run.
We had investigations after the Vietnam War, the Frank Church investigation, looking into what the CIA had done. But today we look at Congress and the response to the revelations of the summary of the CIA
report,
and we don't see the kind of outrage, we don't see the kind of response from public or the media that we had back in 75. Have we lost something in this country?
I think we have. I think that in the years since September 11th, we have become gradually habituated to accepting torture as a necessary piece of the arsenal that supposedly keeps us secure. And I think of it sort of this way. It's as if the government made a deal with us. And it's a fake bargain. Here's the bargain. You let us do whatever we need to do over here on the dark side, and in return, we promise that you will always be secure. And it's a false bargain because it's almost as if it's an offer of immortality. But the reality is that we are not immortal. Every single one of you listening to me talk on the radio today, I hate to tell you this, you are going to die one day. But it's as if the government is offering us this deal that says you will always be secure. And it's also a false deal because as long as people can order automatic weapons on the internet, as long as they can go to the hardware store and buy whatever it takes to create a little tiny bomb, there will be disaffected, angry, crazy college students who blow up the Boston Marathon finish line, and no amount of torture or drones or government surveillance can actually stop that. But we've been told that we actually can. And, you know, the working title for my book was actually A Nation of Cowards. But the publisher thought that that was over the top, so we ended up with Mainstreaming Torture. But the reality is, I think we have been trained to have a habit of being afraid, of being cowards. Because really, what is a coward but the person who says, do whatever it takes in order to preserve my personal safety? That's what we call cowardice. And I think that it's a habit we've developed. And it's interesting, the polling shows, and this is perhaps really surprising, that the further away in time that we get from the actual attacks of September 11th, 2001, you might think that support for torture would actually decrease, but in fact, it's increased. There's more support for torture today in the United States than there was in the years right after September 11th. And that is really distressing to me.
I was going to say, actually, a title for your book might be to turn President Obama's phrase around and to title it, "This is who what we are as a people."
Right.
It's interesting, after the CIA revelations, Hans von Sponeck and Dennis Halliday, two former UN investigators or officials, started a global petition calling for the U.S. to be brought before the International Criminal Court.
Yeah.
Because we're not a member. And, of course,
right,
since the United States has taken no action on its own to prosecute torturers, other than a couple of low-ranking people in Abu Ghraib,
right,
this might be the one thing that happened. I know at the end of your book you have a story about, a very moving story about how our mutual friend Sharon Martinez organized a calling to the government of El Salvador, which had imprisoned a woman, a trade unionist, and your calls made to that government may have saved her life.
Yeah, and this is something that, of course, people do every day around the world. You know, there are people who respond to Amnesty International's calls. And yes, I think that probably the calls that not just me, but a lot of people made did save this one woman, Gloria's, life. And I think, but the reality is that what we need to do in this country is not just save the lives of individuals, which is, of course, crucial, but we need a real reckoning and a real official, not only an official accounting, but real accountability for what was done. You know, Juan Mendez, who is the UN Special Rapporteur for Torture, has repeatedly said and pointed out that although we are not members of the International Criminal Court, the United States did sign and ratify the UN Convention Against Torture, and part of what that convention requires us to do is investigate and prosecute the crime of torture, and we have failed to do that. We have failed in the investigation. It's true that the Senate committee did do this huge piece of work to look at what the CIA has done, but there are a lot of problems even with that. First of all, it took years to get that report released. Secondly, we didn't actually get the report, which is over 6,000 pages long. All we really got was a 500-page executive summary. And thirdly, they never interviewed a single person who was tortured by the CIA. All of their sources of information are from within the CIA and people surrounding it in the government. Not one victim of torture was interviewed for that report. The other problem with it is that it's only the CIA, and we know perfectly well that the CIA is only one of the 17 odd intelligence agencies that make up the whole intelligence apparatus in the United States. So another one that Jeremy Scahill has done a very good job of revealing is the Joint Special Operations Command, which is as it sounds like, it is of elite forces from the various different branches of the U.S. military. So some Navy SEALs, some Army Rangers, some Marines, and so forth, all of them operating essentially under the command of the White House. and without a whole lot of oversight. And that's only two of the possible agencies that have been involved. I think that we do need a new church commission. I think, honestly, that what we need to do is completely dismantle the Central Intelligence Agency, take it apart. And the reason I say that is that I honestly believe that it is a power within the government that even the president has very little control over, and that it's essentially running parallel to the elected and appointed government that we actually have, and it needs to be taken apart.
Well, Rebecca, that's actually what Jack Kennedy was planning on doing, and he went until he ran afoul of other forces. We have just barely covered a bit, but you have talked about the essence of what the problem is, and I want to thank you very much. We have to come back and do this again. We now have to raise some money. Maybe you could make a pitch for community and public radio.
And the
necessity
of it. I will make a pitch for community public radio, because community public radio once came very close to saving my life. And this was a long, long time ago when I was probably not in actual danger, but I was in the local of an umbrella group of trade unions in San Salvador in 1989, and the army came in and completely surrounded the block that the building was located on. We could look up through from the patio and see snipers on various rooftops looking down at us, and we were able to actually get a phone call out. And I spoke with Chuy Barela from KPFA, and he broadcasted the fact that there was a group, a delegation of people from the U.S. in this UNTS local who were surrounded by the military, and people started making calls, and the military backed off. So let me tell you, community radio is crucial. It is crucial to our lives. It's what gives us the information that we're not going to find anywhere else. It's also what gives us the culture we're not going to find anywhere else. It gives us access to music and to the joys of ordinary life that you're not going to find even on NPR. You're not going to find on Top 40 radio. And it remains independent because we support it, because it doesn't count on, you know, mobile or Exxon or any of the big corporations. It doesn't count on, it isn't beholden to anyone but the listeners.
Rebecca, I want to send you a big hug across the wires.
Oh, Jeffrey, it is such a joy to talk to you. And just I hope that your folks will really kick in for this marathon, because you deserve it, they deserve it. And we didn't even talk about all the wonderful work you've done.
But you have been an inspiration. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Rebecca Gordon, author of Mainstreaming Torture, post 11 years. Thanks so much for being our guest today, and we'll talk soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.